So we've been going through the book of Revelation, and we got past the first two of the woes. That is, we've covered nine chapters of Revelation so far. We saw that the first woe was the Saracen invasion. Up to that point, you would have the breakup of the western third of the Roman Empire, the European portion of it. Then, with the first woe, the Saracen invasion, you had another third of the empire taken. All of North Africa and Egypt, Palestine, Syria, into Mesopotamia, and a good deal of Asia Minor. And we saw that that developed exactly the way the book of Revelation had prophesied. Now, the western part of the Roman Empire had undergone complete collapse, and every part of its so-called civilization had crumbled into ruin. The Catholic Church, of course, remained and began gaining strength, because with the empire gone, there was no authority left, nothing to bring order out of chaos except the influence of the church. And so the Pope soon moved into, for all practical purposes, the place formerly occupied by the emperor in ruling the northwesterly third of the original Roman Empire. Now, despite all the things that happened to show God's disapproval of Roman Catholicism, all the same faults remained in the Eastern Church, the Greek Orthodox Church. As a matter of fact, the only substantial differences between them are two. One, that the Eastern Church doesn't recognize the Bishop of Rome as head of their church, and second, that they allow their priests to marry. And third, of course, that they don't use Latin as the only official language of the church. But aside from that, you had the same idolatry, the same worship of the images of the saints and all that. So, throughout North Africa, Egypt, Palestine, Syria, parts of Asia Minor, that was being pretty largely broken up and stamped out by the Saracen invasion, because the Saracen Arabs were out not primarily as looters, although that's always been a large part of Arab ideals, and not primarily seeking more territories to govern, but primarily to spread their new religion, the Mohammedanism. And the whole origin of Mohammedanism was a protest against the total corruption of what had originally been Christianity, and had ceased to be, but still masqueraded under the old name. Then the third woe was the Turkish invasion. The Turks took over what the Arabs had conquered, and in addition, they took all the rest of Asia Minor. Then they moved into the Balkans and took over the southeastern European nations, which had been formerly a part of the Roman Empire, and finally took Constantinople itself, the last vestige of the old Eastern Roman Empire, in the year 1453. And the Turks, while of course they were Mohammedans, they were out primarily for plunder and power. They incidentally brought Mohammedanism along with them, but they were out to steal and to rule. That was their only object. And with that, you get through chapter 10 of the book of Revelation. Now, when you get through chapter 9, I should say, of the book of Revelation. Now, when you get into chapter 10, there's a sudden changing of the subject. The book of Revelation deals with a number of great historical processes that were going on, more or less overlapping, with the one exception of the ending of persecution of Christianity by pagan Rome with the Edict of Toleration by Constantine in 313 A.D., you can say that no part of this was simply an event taking place in a single day. Each was an historical process. It got its start while the one before it was gradually fading out, and in turn it gradually faded out while the next one was beginning. It's at least a three-ring circus, and you have to stop once in a while to look at what's been going on in one of the other rings. So that's what we're doing here when this parenthetical thing is thrown in with the beginning of Revelation chapter 10. John says, "And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud." Your King James Version says a rainbow was upon his head. In the Greek it says the rainbow, which evidently is a bit more important. "And his face was as it were the sun, and his feet were pillars of fire." Now John had seen and talked with a number of angels, but he characterizes this one as especially powerful and important. And the details he tells about him give a number of clues to indicate that this angel most probably is Jesus Christ himself. He was clothed with a cloud. Now that is not generally a characteristic of angels as we see them in the Bible, but the appearance of God himself has been marked by that. You remember when he descended upon Mount Sinai, he came enveloped in a cloud with storm and thunder and lightning. When he led the Israelites on their exodus, again he was enveloped in this pillar of cloud. When he came personally into the tabernacle in the wilderness, why, the cloud pillar descended upon and filled the tabernacle. And when Solomon dedicated the temple and the presence of God came into the temple at that time, it was filled with the cloud again and the glory of God. So this is something that indicates more than just an angel. Now, the rainbow upon his head. Rainbow, of course, was a symbol and promise of divine mercy. You remember that after the flood, God said, "When you see my rainbow in the sky, this is a token to you that I will never again destroy the world with a flood." Then, in Revelation 4, verses 1 to 3, where John receives the vision of the throne of God in heaven, why, there was a rainbow around it. And again, when Ezekiel was given a glimpse of the throne of God, Ezekiel 1, verse 28, he comments upon the rainbow being seen there. Then, John said, his face was as it were the sun. Well, now, at the Transfiguration, you remember Jesus Christ took two of the disciples with him up onto a mountain and allowed his divine nature to become more visible there when Moses and Elijah came to talk with him. And it mentions then that his face shone brightly as the sun. And again, in the first chapter of Revelation, where John got his vision of Jesus Christ standing among the seven lampstands, he comments again that his face was as the sun in its brightness. and his feet like pillars of fire. Well, as seen by Ezekiel, Ezekiel 1, verses 26 and 27, he mentions he got his vision of Yahweh as shining like fire. John, in Revelation 1:15, mentioned how the feet of Jesus Christ shone with light. He mentioned it as being like the glow of molten bronze. You know how iron glows white hot long before it melts. And even bronze, which melts at a lower temperature, would be glowing white hot when molten. And the importance of what this particular angel does is again further confirmation that this was Jesus Christ himself. Then in Revelation 10:2, John says he had in his hand a little book, and your King James Version just says open. But the exact Greek is a little book having been opened, implying it was formerly closed and had been opened. And he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot on the earth. Well, we've run into the opening of a book or scroll, of course, earlier than this, in the fifth chapter of Revelation. We have Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God, being the only one found worthy to open the scroll that was sealed shut with the seven seals. And you remember that while he didn't tell the writing on that scroll, as each seal was opened, there took place an historical event which showed the significance of it. Now, it having been opened, and by the way, while your King James Version uses the term book, the actual Greek here, biblion, a little scroll, is the same as it was in the fifth chapter where you have the scroll sealed with the seven seals. A book of pages bound together along one edge would have been called a codex. That came into general use much later than this. It was still a rarity even in John's time. So he had this book or scroll having been opened. And now he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land. Well, the Bible, of course, was strictly a closed book under the Catholic Church. They were bitterly opposed to any but the priesthood ever getting a glimpse into the Bible, and they greatly discouraged it on the part of the priesthood, for that matter. The Vatican determined what church doctrine was, and as long as you'd been told by the Pope what the doctrine was, why, what need was there for you to look in the Bible to see whether it was there or not? You were supposed to believe that the Pope was the successor to God.
Still true.
So, they had kept it closed. In the first place, it was only in Latin, which the common people didn't understand, and if they got a chance to look at one, it therefore wouldn't mean anything to them. Secondly, no copies were available except these great bulky manuscript volumes in the monasteries and churches, and those were not made available to anybody but the priests and the monks. The Bible was very effectively kept out of the hands of the people, and deliberately, because the hierarchy of the Catholic Church has been conscious of the falsity and evil of their doctrines from the beginning. And they didn't want it exposed, and it certainly would have been exposed had anybody been able to get a look at the Bible. Now, the opening of the Bible to the people was the direct cause of the Protestant Reformation. Up to this time, you had only one Christian church in all of Western Europe, at least it called itself Christian. That was the Roman Catholic Church. It stamped out with murder any attempt to worship other than under its forms in its churches, and you had the same thing in substance with the Greek Orthodox Church in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Well, you had reserved to the possession of the Catholic Church only some Latin translations, all based, of course, on Jerome's Vulgate. Then there were around some of the Greek manuscripts, but there were almost none of those in Western Europe. That had remained where the civilization was Greek and where the language was generally Greek, in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. So, although universities had been growing up before this time, Greek was practically an unknown language in Western Europe, even in the universities. Then, after all the rest of the eastern part of the empire had fallen to the Turks, it was evident they were going to take Constantinople. And from a few years before 1453 up to a few years after, there was a great flight from Constantinople of many of the Greek scholars who took with them their Greek manuscripts, and they fled someplace to get out of the path of these barbarous Turks, so they went to Western Europe, and of course they went to the various universities. The university at Paris had been established sometime in the early 1000s, and there were two or three other great universities besides several smaller ones by that time. So these scholars, with their knowledge of the Greek language and their Greek manuscripts, showed up at the universities. And Greek became a known language among the well-educated, the scholars, in Western Europe. Well, from about, say, 1458 and after, you had the teaching of the Greek language in the universities, the common thing, and in all the universities there were some of the Greek manuscripts, the Septuagint of the Old Testament and the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament available for study. Now, note the importance of a series of dates and the events that happened on them. In 1454, you had the invention of printing in Germany. In 1476, Caxton introduced printing into England. In 1516, Erasmus published his printed Greek New Testament, which probably was a substantial factor in the enlightenment of Martin Luther. In 1518, Zwingli printed the first Swiss New Testament. In 1522, Luther put out his New Testament in German. And in the next 10 years, that went into 57 editions. You can see how hungry the people were for the Word of God. In 1526, Tyndale published a New Testament in England, written in English. The same year, the Bible was printed in Sweden. In 1535, or Tyndale's was a New Testament only, in 1526. In 1535, Coverdale published the complete Bible in English. 1537, you had the complete Bible published in Denmark, in their language. In England, you had Matthew's Bible in English. In 1539, under royal approval and command, the Great Bible, as they called it, was printed under the supervision of Coverdale, and by royal command, a copy placed in every church in England for the use of the parishioners. Now, this was a large book, and it was kept chained to the pulpit so that you didn't have somebody taking it home for a few years of private study by himself. This was for the congregation in general. So, the open book, available to be read by God's people, and you notice the only places where this spread were the Israel lands. The British Isles, the territories of what is now Germany, Austria, and the Scandinavian nations. It was stamped out, of course, by fire and sword in all the non-Israel lands that were ruled by the Catholic Church. So, just as Jesus Christ is the one who gave John this revelation of all history to come, it was Jesus Christ who caused the open book to be available, which was the means of carrying into effect the things to come. Then in Revelation 10, verses 3 and 4, John goes on, and he cried, that's the angel, he cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roars. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write. And when I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. Well, again, this loud voice like the roaring of a lion is another confirmation that this was the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And you remember Revelation 5, verse 3, calls him both the Lamb of God and the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So he holds out the open book and shouts triumphantly like a lion's roar. Now by opening the seven-sealed scroll, he was proceeding with the process of redemption, because we were told in that fifth chapter of Revelation that he had redeemed us. Now, presenting the book after it was opened, he's carrying into effect the results of that redemption. Now, about those seven thunders which were not to be written down. There have been two different interpretations of that, and no conclusive evidence to support one rather than the other, so you can take your choice. Some have said thunder and lightning normally accompany the presence of God. In the Exodus, when God came down on the top of Mount Sinai, you had the terrible peals of thunder and the flashes of lightning. In Revelation 4, verse 5, when John was given a vision of God seated on his throne in heaven, there was lightning flashing and terrible peals of thunder coming out from the throne. So, some have said, these accompanying a divine revelation here were the thunders from the throne of God, and John was told not to write them because this was not yet the time to reveal what they said. It would be premature. Well, it's a possibility. It's arguable. The other interpretation And remember, most books on Revelation have been written by people who could see no evil in anything but the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was to blame for the fall of Adam and Noah's flood and the slavery in Egypt and everything else, besides all the things afterward. And while there's plenty to blame the Catholic Church for, on the other hand, the Catholic Church is the symptom rather than the disease. And it was the same people who are now corrupting the Protestant churches who had corrupted the Catholic Church. They said this: the Pope was very fond of issuing proclamations claiming to speak with the voice of God and ordering this and that, or preventing this and that, forbidding it. And many writers had spoken of these proclamations as the thunders of the Vatican. So this represented the various efforts of the popes to condemn the reading of the Bible by the common people. And therefore, being falsehoods, they were not to be written down. And they say, by way of comparison now, note that in Revelation 21, verse 5, John was told this: "And he said unto me, Write, for these words are true and faithful." Hence, if you're told don't write something else, it may well be an indication that these are not true. On the other hand, supporting the first view, that he was told not to write them because it would be premature to reveal what they said, compare Daniel 12, verses 4 and 9, where Daniel was told, "Shut up the words and seal the book, even unto the time of the end." Now, the things Daniel was told were direct revelations through an angel, and they were true. But the explanation was not to be given prematurely. Well, you can argue either theory very plausibly, so take your choice. In any event, John didn't write what the seven thunders said. Now, John didn't just say he saw this mighty angel, but he mentioned particularly the angel, evidently facing south, toward where John was. He set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth. Now, going up and standing on something is certainly a way of and a symbol of taking possession of it, isn't it? The angel here was taking over command and barring any further advance by the satanic forces that were trying to stamp out what he was doing. So he put his right foot upon the sea. Now, in 1588, you had the Spanish Armada sent to conquer England expressly because England was Protestant, and at the urgings of the Pope, the King of Spain got this enormous fleet together to go and conquer England, murder all the Protestants, and compel the kingdom to become Catholic. Well, what happened to it? The Spanish Armada had 129 ships, 65 of them being huge ships of over 700 tons. They had 8,000 sailors and 19,000 soldiers aboard. The English had a total navy with which to resist this of only 80 ships. And out of the 80, only 30 of them were what they called ships of the line, big enough and with enough guns to really take part in battle with some chance of accomplishing something. Well, the English sailed out bravely enough. You remember Sir Francis Drake was in his hometown of Plymouth bowling at the time the word came that this enormous fleet had been sighted out in the English Channel and better go out and do something. And he said, well, all in due time. So he finished his game of bowling, then went aboard his ship and started out to battle the Spanish fleet. Well, the English fought bravely, and they did sink or damage several of the Spanish ships. Mostly what they did was to drive the Spanish fleet into the port of Calais across the channel in France, where they wanted to reorganize. But by the time they started out again, a terrific storm had come up. The Spanish fleet could not turn back to land on the southerly coast of England because they could make no headway into that storm. All they could do was go north in the channel, and they didn't dare approach the coast then because they'd have been wrecked. They could only hope to go up around the coast of Scotland and come down on the westerly side, and in the process, two-thirds of their ships were destroyed. 54 out of this original 129 ships were all that avoided sinking. It's an interesting thing to note. Queen Elizabeth had a medal struck to commemorate this. On this, she took a phrase from the Song of Moses after they had successfully passed the Red Sea. In Exodus 15:10, in the Song of Moses, he said, "Thou didst blow with thy winds, and the sea covered them." That was speaking of the crossing of the Red Sea and the destruction of the pursuing Egyptians. So on this medal, there was the inscription, "Thou didst blow with thy winds, and they were scattered." And the name of God, Yahweh, in Hebrew letters, also appeared on this medal. And do you need any other indication that this was truly an Israel people celebrating their deliverance? Well, you know, of course, how the Pope endeavored to stamp out Protestantism by land. He commanded all the kings to use their armies to kill all the heretics, and he was only able to get it done in the non-Israel lands because the kings and nobility of what later became Austria and Germany and up into Scandinavia refused to have anything to do with it. Practically all of them adopted Protestantism themselves, and they protected the Protestants. So the advance of the forces of Antichrist under the Pope was definitely halted. As the angel planted his feet on the sea and the land, he stopped it then and there. Then John goes on in Revelation 10, verses 5 and 6. "And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven and swore by him that liveth forever and ever, and who created heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein." Your King James Version goes on to say that there should be time no longer. Now, this is a good example here of how much wishful thinking is substituted for translation. Whatever the church hierarchy has determined to be its doctrine, why, if the Bible doesn't say it, why, that's too bad for the Bible. Alter the Bible till it does say it. And some of the best modern translations that we're accustomed to rely upon most of the time make the same blunder. I looked up a few of them here. Smith and Goodspeed, "There shall be no more delay." Rotherham, who ordinarily is scrupulously accurate, "Delay, no longer shall there be." Ferrar Fenton, again, ordinarily a stickler for accuracy, "That time should no longer intervene." Moffat, "That there shall be no more delay." Weymouth, "There shall be no further delay." And the recently published Jerusalem Bible, "The time of waiting is over." Now, some other writers have said of this same phrase that it could be translated, "There shall be one more time." Now, they ought to make up their minds whether time no more or one more time, you would think. They have argued, well, a time, as a prophetic expression in the Bible, is 360 years. So, of one more time, what would it indicate? Well, for example, from the Spanish Armada's destruction, 1588, 360 more years would bring us to 1948. And by 1948, all the illusions that anybody had about World War II were dispelled, and we saw that all we had done was to break down European civilization to pave the way for Russia. Well, some of them say there shall be no more time or no more delay, others one more time. Now, the actual Greek, word for word, and not even changing their word order, phrasing it, "Because time not yet shall be." Young's literal translation, putting it into the easier understood English word order, "That time shall not be yet." Now, that's the actual literal Greek. How can you make anything out of the expression, "The time shall not yet be," that there shall be no more time? In other words, your King James Bible is the least trustworthy thing on the subject of religion that you can read, because always it has to be under suspicion. I don't mean it's always wrong, and you notice that I quote from it a great deal after first checking up to find whether this is a place where it's right. But it does have to be under suspicion always, because there are so many of these errors in it. So the angel swore that the time shall not yet be, and that fits in with the next verse, Revelation 10:7. "But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he has declared to his servants, the prophets." You remember, you had these seven angels, each given a trumpet, and each in turn to sound a blast on his trumpet. And we had been through the first six of these angels, and we saw that as each trumpet blast sounded, it signaled an historical event, which took place the way the Bible described it here. Now you have this parenthetical thing thrown in here in between, before you get to the seventh trumpet and before you get to the third of the three woes. So when the seventh trumpet sounds, it says the mystery of God would be finished. But now you have to avoid getting too impatient to see it all at once, because remember that every one of these things have been not instantaneous events of one day. They have been processes which consumed at the minimum decades and generally centuries to complete. And since it's presumably consistent with what's gone on before, you can expect this seventh trumpet to be a process covering a considerable period of time. We don't get to that until after there's still another one of these prophetical things thrown in here, besides the one that we're working on tonight. Then Revelation 10, verses 8 to 10, John goes on. And the voice which I heard from heaven spoke unto me again, and said, Go, and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel which stands upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went unto the angel, and said unto him, Give me the little book. And he said unto me, Take it, and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand, and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. Now you're constantly running into sermons and articles by ministers, if they ever get into the book of Revelation at all, in which they show they can't understand any of this symbolism, and for the very good reason that the symbolism is practically never new. It had been introduced earlier in the Bible, and they haven't read the Bible, so when they come to the last use of that symbolism in the book of Revelation, they don't know what it's talking about. Now, this matter of taking this book, which obviously was the Bible, to eat it, and it would be sweet as honey in his mouth. You've got several previous uses of that in the Bible. We'll touch on two of them here tonight. You remember that, as is always the case with organized, institutionalized religion, the worship in the temple at Jerusalem had degenerated into total paganism. All the worship of God, Yahweh God, had ceased, and there were pagan altars set up within the temple courts, and everything was going to pot. And then you had the last good king, you might almost say the only good king, except David, Josiah, who ordered the temple cleaned up, the accumulated rubbish thrown out of it. And when that was done, under some of the rubbish piled there, they found a scroll of the law. It mentions that in particular, although probably it was the Old Testament as far as it had been written at that time. Well, this was brought out and read, and of course it produced consternation immediately, because the way it so bitterly condemned the things they'd been doing and said this was leading to the wrath of God as punishment for it, and they took it to the king. And when he read it, he was just appalled. Remember now, he has the responsibility for this nation. And he wondered, was it too late to avoid the wrath of God? So he began a reform. He ordered the pagan idols and altars and that sort of thing taken out of the temple, and the idols in the high places destroyed, and a resumption of the worship of Yahweh according to the Old Testament. The prophet Jeremiah, speaking of that incident, the finding of this scroll and the recovery of what had been completely lost, the words of God. Jeremiah 15, verse 16, he says, Thy words were found, and I did eat them, and thy word was unto me the joy and rejoicing of mine heart. For I am called by thy name, O Yahweh, God of hosts. He was. His name, Yirmiyah, Yah shall arise. And as you know, Yah is the shortened form of Yahweh. Now, he doesn't mean, of course, that he sat down and gnawed on some old dry parchment.